Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Hi, welcome back. This is Mark Anthony Rossi with Strength to Be Human. We're doing something a bit different for the next couple months. I'm going to do a segment called Classic Spotlight. This will be episode number 25, Thoughts on Edgar Allan Poe. Now, I figured rather than just go through the various topics and subtopics of writing literature and even the interviews with people, it's nice to just sort of take a break and reflect upon some of the masters of the past, people that might have influenced us or at least moved us, you know, as readers just as much as writers. And Edgar Allan Poe was certainly one of the first. He's also in many ways one of the most misunderstood. So I thought it'd be a good idea to talk about a bit him and also do a little exploration of maybe who he was, what he was trying to do with his writing, and how it still affects people today. So I'm pretty excited about this. It's something different and certainly interesting. I've been wanting to do it for a while now, so I'm definitely excited to move forward. So who we got here? We got an American, Edgar Allan Poe. All right, born in 1809 in Boston. He was the child of traveling actors who back then, that's literally how they made their living. And it was not always an understood living, kind of the complete opposite of what an actor is today. Back then, you know, people really didn't take that seriously. In fact, they would have taken a poet like Edgar Allan Poe more seriously than it would have taken a traveling actor. So I'm not really sure if the rigors or the health or germs or just back in those days, but both his parents wind up dying. And that left him to be taken in and adopted by a tobacco merchant. And that would be the Allen family. And he was a fellow that was a distant person, somebody that was just strictly into business, wasn't exactly the most personable kind of fellow. And I think in many ways, he was somebody that probably through no fault of his own wasn't some perfect plan, but I think that he sort of pushed Poe practically into literature, because I think that from what we've seen and we've learned about Poe, he kind of knew already he was a writer early on. And for a while, he tried to keep this guy happy by going into the business and or learning things, but he was simply not interested in that. He even went to the West Point Academy to try to keep his adopted father happy, and he got himself kicked out on purpose because that's just not really where he wanted to be at. And even some of the people that served with him realized that he was a writer and that he was a creative person. He just didn't belong in that kind of environment that was very structured and rigid. Not to say that discipline wasn't for Poe, because any writer has to have a form of discipline in order to be able to move on and create things and have a life, and he did. But that sort of discipline wasn't for him. He just wasn't interested in bossing, you know, people around or preparing for war or something. He wanted to be a creative person, and because that's exactly who he was. So he wound up distancing himself away from his adopted family. Now, there's always been a lot of stories and a lot of suppositions, a lot of even stereotypes about, you know, the unhappy home life, and that makes you a tormented soul, and you know, and then you can put that into your creativity and have incredible stories. And if there's a connection between a lot of the stuff that he did and his early life, and there's not really that much. There's not much about the Gothic horror that he did that really has anything to do with his home life. I mean, he still loved his adopted mother, and is still close. He stuck close with her until she died. I mean, he didn't care much for the adopted father. And you don't really see a whole lot of that in the work. Somebody says And a couple of people do believe that the Castle of Amontillado, where, you know, he's literally walling up an enemy in the basement of a wine cellar, you know, maybe that's maybe his father back there. Maybe he's doing some kind of revengeful thing. But he's had some other stories, even like the Black Hat, you know, where the revenge was on the animal doing it to the person. So kind of hard to figure out which one that would be the case of. I mean, the Mask of the Red Death, you can also say there's some horror in there and revenge as well. But also, you could say it was an allegory about the tuberculosis that he continued to face in his life around the people that loved him. Poe was a pretty classic guy. He wasn't all that unusual of a fellow in the sense that he got along more with women than he got along with men. There's a lot of people that are like that. I'm pretty much like that. So it's not too unusual in my opinion. Now, keep this in mind. A lot of the horror, the gothic, the things that he wrote, not only is he famous for that, but there were enemies that he had that wrote biographies and wrote horrible obituaries and kept spreading tales. They used that sort of stuff against him and to sort of poison, you know, his entire public image out there. And for years, until people really did the research, people believed that. Yeah, Poe was a drug addict. Yeah, Poe was an alcoholic. Poe was a wife beater. Poe was a psycho. Poe was a serial killer. Poe was this. Poe was that. Poe, my favorite one, Poe is a devil worshiper. We don't even know if he believed in God. So kind of hard to be a devil worshiper if you're not even sure you believe in God. He never really made a much reference to that. Never, of course, went to church in any serious way. And doesn't seem to have any kind of real religious anything. So a little hard to believe on that, too. But that's what happens when people's imaginations run wild, when they don't look into things seriously. You know, it's sort of like, in my ways, it's sort of like an Adolf Hitler sort of situation. People wrote off all his crimes as him being insane. And then you find out when you do the research that he was actually pretty sane. And he's just a sick, mad, you know, hating individual, but not somebody that if you put in a court, if he would ever to survive, you would have found out he was sane and deserved a death sentence. And you wouldn't be able to put this guy away for anything like that because he knew what he was doing. And I would say the same thing for Edgar Allan Poe. One of the things that we discovered through research and through going through his papers is not only was he a brilliant literary critic, definitely fearless. Boy, he just did not care if he criticized somebody or not and what ramifications would that have, even though a lot of those people came after him later and hurt his reputation for a while. But he still didn't care. In fact, if you could have told him, hey, this is going to hurt you later, I don't think he would have cared because he was somebody that stuck to the truth. He was somebody that he knew exactly who he was and that's who he was going to be. He didn't run away. He didn't live in denial. And he had a hard life. We'll talk about that. But here is a writer that lived exactly the way he wanted to live. He only lived for 40 years. He died in 1849. Remember, born in 1809. So didn't exactly have a long life. But one that was fulfilled with so much that we can still celebrate today, over 200 years later. So, all right, so let's go with that. So here we go. A writer, Edgar Allan Poe, who was amongst the first of many things. And this was also makes him very interesting. Some of these things you might not be aware of, okay? Edgar Allan Poe was the first writer to ever actually try to make a living from it. And I'm sorry to say that if you could look under the definition of starving artist, you probably should see his photograph next to it because he's probably one of the first that was also of the starving artists. This guy was hungry, no doubt about it. I'm told that he didn't even have enough money for lots of clothes. So oftentimes when he actually started making a few dollars and have to go out there to do appearances and read The Raven, which is what a lot of people asked him to do when he became more known. He'd wear the same outfit to lots of places. He would just simply take care of it to the best of his ability, mend it and clean it and press it and do everything possible that at least if you saw him, even if you heard someone say, that was the same outfit he wore last month, well, at least it was clean and he was neat. trying to do the best of his performance. But I think he did that more out of professional pride as a writer. I mean, I don't really think he would have cared otherwise. I mean, he doesn't really strike me from learning about him that somebody really cared too much about fashion or you know, if you said, hey, I don't like that bow tie, because he'd be the kind of guy that says, I don't care about my bow tie either, but what do you think about this story? That's a classic writer right there. No, that's exactly the type of personality you want to hear about and you want to read about. You want to be like, and that's why one of the many reasons he should be admired. So the first to try to make a living, the first to create a science fiction story. He was one of the first persons to create a science fiction story. You'll find out that Jules Verne, the great science fiction writer from France, said that he was a major influence over him. Incredible. You'll find out through this program that many a times it's the French writers that realized how great he was. It was people in England and France that were celebrating him, that were excited about him, because many of the American writers, they were still concerned about his reputation and how that would affect him. So we had a number of writers that they secretly admired him, but they just didn't want to say too much about him. They didn't want to be connected with the tales that was being told. Oh, he drinks a lot. Oh, he takes opium. Oh, his wives keep dying. He's bad luck. He's a weirdo. You know, all of that stuff. That's, you know, so people, they didn't want the reputation, but they knew that this was a man of letters and a man of brilliance, somebody that should be admired. And they also knew deep down inside that he'd be somebody that's going to stand the test of time. You can just tell. It's kind of like, I bring it sometimes up when I talk about art. It's like Prince. If you ever got a chance to go onto the YouTube, check out that 1979 interview he had. A very short interview after he did his song, Wanna Be Your Lover, on the Dick Clark Show. Check that out. It's small, what he has to say. But if you see his body language, if you see his face, you see his conversation with Dick Clark, one of the greats. This is a man who wasn't nervous. This is a man who actually knew exactly who he was, had the poise. You could just tell. You could look at the guy and say, yeah, he had it. He was going someplace. You could just tell. And I think Edgar Allan Poe, for many people, when they read even one of his stories back then, they were like, yeah, this guy's got the goods. I just wasn't had all those crazy rumors and all this dark stuff around him, because I could probably hang with him more often. So that sort of scared people away, unfortunately. He had so many enemies and so many rumors. I mean, and what can he really do? He was not a networker. He simply wasn't. He was against that sort of thing. I think he felt it would have compromised his integrity as an artist, especially as a literary critic. And you know, that's true, actually. But most people don't go to the extent that he did. I mean, he was a purist in this sort of thing. In many ways, that might have hurt him as well. I don't believe it would have hurt him in the sense that he would never have gone to be the great writer that he became, or he would never have gone to be the famous writer that he became, but he might have had a little bit more of an easier life if he could have toned that down a bit, if he could have did a little bit of glad-handing, a little bit of politics, and a little bit of networking. I don't mean to some gross extent, but something. But he just simply wasn't capable of doing that. He had his way and his integrity, and it didn't include any of that. And in many ways, you know, that harmed him, at least in his personal life. No doubt about it. All right, so the first to try to make a living, the first to write a detective. Oh, yeah, excuse me. Yes, first to write a detective story. Sir Arthur Conan O'Donnell over in England completely credit him for Sherlock Holmes, for his story, the murders in the Rue Morgue. His French detective that solved that case, there you go. By using rationalization, by using some logic. These are all the things that later on was used in Sherlock Holmes, borrowed from Edgar Allan Poe. First science fiction, first detective story, first guy to really try to make a living as a writer. The first serious American writer that other people across the seas in France and England in particular had said that affected them, that influenced them. I mean, it's amazing that he was able to do that, especially in, remember, those are the days where, you know, it took months to get any kind of communication to anybody over there. They didn't even have the telegraph yet. So it's just amazing that when they found out who he was and what he was doing, how impressed they were. And many of them Especially the Baudelaire, the French poet, who, by the way, it was a man of scandal from one end to the other. And I don't mean scandal that he was gay and had a crazy abusive relationship with another gay French writer, Valera. But hey, he was a guy that just did not care about the kind of life he lived. And even he was like, this nonsense about Poe makes no sense. He could tell that that was not a man of scandal, that that was scandal being put around him by jealous people. So he was a man that understood that, and God bless him. Let's talk a little bit about this whole Gothic thing, very scary, interesting themes. Where would he might have gotten that? Well, we know from some of his nonfiction work, especially the philosophy of furniture, that he kept an eye on Europe, especially in Germany. So he knew a lot about the Gothic-type tales that came out of there, stuff like from the Grimm Brothers. He knew about that, and he had some influence from that, and just simply put it into his own making. I'm not convinced, like I said before, that his childhood, which, by the way, was not that rough. If you think about it on paper, all right, his parents die. He's with this jerk, you know, who pretty much adopted him. But it really wasn't that rough, because this guy wasn't poor when he was being raised by the family. He was with a wealthy family. He never went hungry. He went to the best schools, University of Virginia and West Point. The woman that adopted him with the husband loved him. He had a very good relationship with her. So I don't really think those things affected him that much at all. If you look at the conduct, he really didn't. I think what really affected the man was every woman that he seemed to have a connection with, which he got a lot of his energy from, a lot of his possibly even financial security from, you know, forgive me, but that seems to be the case. But he also got a lot of emotional support from them. That's where he seemed to have gotten the most energy as a human being, or maybe even as a man, were from women. And they all seemed to die of tuberculosis, which was a horrible disease back then. It eventually affected your lungs, you cough up blood, and you die. Usually it took about 5 years from when you contracted it to when you died. So it was a slow way to die, in a horrible way. Painful to see, and he saw it all. That, I would say, would affect in a man's ability to be a happier person, to have a more gloomier output, you know, and to maybe invest some of that stuff that you saw, you know, constantly on the people that you loved, how that would affect your writing and your outlook and even your psychological makeup. So yes, it doesn't make him an insane person. Whether he was truly manic depressive or schizophrenic or bipolar, I don't know. I don't know how we could know. Even from the letters he left and his writings and people's conversations, things they had said about him, hard to know. We know he's gloomy. We know he's writing some dark stuff, okay? Sometimes some really detailed stuff. Like, wow, man. I mean, if you hear about how the body was chopped up and put underneath the boards of the house in one of his story, I mean, he was detailed about it. And it read like one of those crime dramas or reports that you see now in the 21st century. And he's writing this in the 1800s. That alone would probably freak people out. I mean, I still read it to this day and go, man, that's some graphic stuff. And we know that he had no history of violence at all. And it never hurt or hit anybody. And so how he would know this, or how he would use his imagination to be this detailed, and why he would want to be detailed on a story that, if you read most of his stories, they would be considered flash fiction. We ought to consider him the father of flash fiction in many instances, I think, especially on The Telltale Heart. I mean, come on. Why? And it's such a short story, you go to that detail. Because it's obvious that some of those things, like he wrote in that kind of description, he knew it was necessary to push the reader out there, to kind of convince them that this thing was going on, to give that impact, especially when you have that kind of interesting ending to it all. So he was willing to do that when other writers back then would have never have done that. I mean, he went beyond the Gothic writers of Germany. They never went that far. But hey, makes him not only unique, makes him very American, because it's something that I would say it is in the American character to take the next step, to do something beyond what other people's are doing because you feel that you're free to do so. And if there's anything that that guy felt was in his writing, that he was free, because it's obvious he didn't feel very free in his life. I don't think he felt free in his childhood with all these decisions trying to be forced upon him when he knew he wanted to be a writer. I don't think he felt free in his personal romantic life when, you know, the people that he loves are dying in front of him. Kind of hard to feel free about that. He might have been the most free after everybody died and he never went back to another woman again. We don't see any evidence of that. So for the last few years of his life, that guy was on his own. He got a couple of good literary jobs, kind of made a few bucks doing that. Made his name as well that way doing it. Won a couple of great writing contests. Did some real speaking engagements to make some money. Moved around a bit. So he was doing things. But at that point then, he was alone. Alone. After one of his poems. But yeah, he was an alone guy. No doubt. And it's sad to say he died the same way, alone. In a horrible manner. You know, left like some kind of bum with no name, even though, you know, lying there on the street in an alleyway in Baltimore was perhaps one of the greatest writers, you know, that ever put pen to page. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of these stories, okay? One of my favorites, maybe just because I like the whole cat thing, the animal, you know, doing something, you know, for some social justice, the black cat, always interesting, the animal. You know, pretty much knew that this guy was a paranoid killer and made sure he got caught. That was always very unique. You don't really see a whole lot of that in many stories, even today. They'd rather make the animal talk, you know, rather than what Poe did. It's like, why do I need to make the animal talk? I mean, he's doing enough to get me put in jail. Thanks, you stupid blue black cat. But that's an unusual take on it. So I like how he did that. Definitely very interesting. The Mask of the Red Death. Definitely an easy one to tell that tuberculosis runs through it because blood's all over the place. And they're having this big masquerade, which I think it is also the illusions of the masquerade of living a life that you know is going to be crappy because the people around you are dying and coughing up blood, and then one day they won't cough anymore, and then that's that. So the Mask of the Red Death, definitely about that. You could see for sure, one of the few stories you could truly see a serious glimpse into his life, into his own mind and his feelings about that. If you read that story again and again, you'll catch more and more of that. It's probably one of the most, I feel, autobiographical of all the stories. The Fall of the House of Usher, a story incredibly, I think, misunderstood. Folks, The Fall of the House of Usher is not just another haunted house story. It's not really a haunted house story at all. The House of the Usher is a family and all the stupid mistakes and sins they made and how they fell because of their inner decay and their poor choices and unethical behavior. That's what that story is about. It's not about really a house. That's just part of the design of the story. Now, is he talking about his other family? I don't think so, because, you know, that guy was wealthy. He didn't destroy anything. His wife died, sure, but, you know, a guy like that, he just moved on and married somebody else again. It's not a big deal to him, because all he was a businessman, John Allen, the man that adopted him. So I think it's just a tale that he came up with, and it was very interesting to use the play on the family and a house and make it into an interesting dark setting. Definitely one of the more famous ones he's known for. He's got a lot of interesting adventurous ones like The Pit and the Pendulum. You know, you got this thing swinging around, might kill you, and, you know, that's interesting. The Gold Bug, it's like a story that, and he won a big award for that and some real money. Sort of like a decoding story. So that's interesting how he was able to do something like that. He never did that again, really. But I always liked that one. I always thought that one's interesting as well. He's known more for his gothic fiction, for this horror stuff. And nothing wrong with that. But Edgar Allan Poe is a far more interesting writer and far more brilliant beyond that, when you start looking at beyond the fiction, start going into the poetry. It's a complete contrast, night and day, to the fiction. The fiction is dark. It's interesting, but it's dark. Somebody's bleeding. Somebody's dying. You know, you got a giant ape running around killing people in the Murders of Rue Morgue. I mean, you got some strange stuff going on over there. The poetry, completely the opposite. Here you see a man, and I don't know why he doesn't get enough credit for that, because you hear about the Raven all day long, and we talk about that. I'm not against that. It's super, super fantastic poem, one of the most famous poems in the history of all writing. Got that, okay? And it's fantastic, but if you look at the contrast of the dark person he's supposed to be, and the dark writing and all those nonsense rumors, and then you see the poetry, you see a man that has classical romantic understandings. Does poems, especially about women, I mean, he truly loved these women that died. He loved that woman that became his stepmother, like if she was his mother, because he never really got the chance to know his mother. Traveling actress and dies. Never got to know her. But you can see he has that classical romance in him. Wasn't corny either. You can see how serious it was, and sincere and heartfelt and beautiful art. It really is. A lot of interesting poems. Most of them not very dark. They might be considered haunting in the romantic, sad kind of way, like the melancholy I used to say, but I wouldn't consider them any kind of horror like the fiction, because they still stuck with you as somebody that loved. And maybe didn't always feel that he got that love back, but still loved anyway. At least when that man died early, he knew something about love. And he knew that he was able to write that into his canon of works. You know, it kind of leaves us a trail to not just call him one thing. You know, I don't really think he was thinking that when he's writing that. Let me write a few love poems so they don't think I'm nuts. But that's really how it comes out, really, in my opinion. It gives you evidence to say, hey, he's just not one thing, or he's not just some dark fellow. Here's a guy over there that loved women. He tried to respect them, and, you know, it just didn't turn out well for him, unfortunately. Another thing about Edgar Allan Poe, when you consider him as a fiction writer, and this is not to put down anybody in the present, but Stephen King or Clive Barker, somebody that's probably even more brilliant, you know, Peter Straub. I mean, we can name bunches of them here, okay? None of them have anything on Edgar Allan Poe in terms of being a classical genius that had an intellectual prowess. I mean, you read his Poetic Principle, and you read many of his essays, The Philosophy of Composition. You could see that this is a man that understood writing. He's writing down some of the rules about what he thought, about some of the things that he actually practiced himself. So, in many ways, he's not just a horror writer. He's not just a romantic poet. He's the writer's writer with thinking beyond his writing. Nobody does that. So, again, it makes him an additional individual in terms of, I could have easily seen him doing a lecture tour in a college. And maybe, if he lived longer than 40 years, that's something he could have been doing. Maybe that's a way he could have actually made some regular income, talking at schools about his writing and about writing in general. Makes a couple of bucks. It wouldn't have surprised me if that be a way that he could have lived onward, but he never got that far. But I could have easily seen him do that, because not only did he have those leanings, he had that knowledge, because he was creating and learning and becoming his own professor of English and becoming his own teacher in many ways, because he was just that brilliant. Consider that. We don't have very few people that do that today. We got a lot of people that, you know, they stick to the genre that they do, and then they do it well, and it served them well, and that's great. And I don't take anything away from our modern writers, but nobody has been an Edgar Allan Poe, and I don't know if anyone ever will be. He's just that incredibly unique and that incredibly interesting. And consider this, okay? Here's a guy that literally influenced many American writers, even though I wish they would have came out for him more. They did later on when they figured out the nonsense that was going on. But he influenced the world. And in the end, what he gets, he gets jealousy. I have an episode coming up on that, by the way. Writers and jealousy. Horrible thing. Edgar Allan Poe, one of the real first victims of that. That somebody literally writes a nasty obituary and then writes a nasty biography about him with all these incredible tales that were all false. So false that people across the ocean know that's false. I can't believe that's a bunch of nonsense. You know, and how do we know this is nonsense? Well, because many of the things they were talking about completely out of character for him. I mean, there were people back then, including writers in America, that admired him, that thought he was weird. Yeah. Thought he was creepy. Yeah. That's to be expected. I don't even think that maligns a person's character. You read a bunch of stories like that, well, you're going to get that creepy tag. That's just the way it is. But all the other stuff, drug addict and abuser and witchcraft lover, opium user, I mean, what is that, fighter in bars, and just all this nonsense. It was never true. One of the first things we learned, especially from one of his first major biographers, I read this book, Mournful Remembrance by Kenneth Silverman, one of the first real biographies that broke down all this nonsense with clear proof and detail. I remember taking my motorcycle and driving over to the West Covina Mall in California to go buy this book when it came out. That's how excited I was to get it. I think that was 1991, just before the Bosnian War, actually. And one of the first things that Mr. Silverman had mentioned is, there's no way this guy could be a regular drunk and opium addict and all this nonsense, because he got access to all his papers and he saw all the rewrites. He saw the rewrites of The Raven so many times for months on end, constantly fixing that. You don't do that stuff if you're a drunk fool. You just don't. And you certainly don't write it just on the first take. It's very rare that any of us do that. And guess what? The geniuses don't do that either. Especially not on the greatest work. It's a work in progress. It's a work of work. It is a lot more work. It's rewriting. It's reworking. Redoing. Revisiting. A lot of okay? So it was obvious from reading all those various versions, which apparently he saved, that you could tell. No way this guy can be this way. No way. You can't edit and redo things if you're a slobbering drunk fool in a cabin somewhere, half naked, which is how people was describing him. You know? Feeding animals your breadcrumbs, talking to the moon. I mean, this is the nonsense that people were selling about him for a while, because they were jealous of pretty much his greatness. Because we are talking about somebody that is one of the great writers, not only of his century, but of all history. So they discovered that. And of course, they also examined the notes in people's journals and in diaries and what people had said about him publicly. When they heard him speak, when they heard him give the recitation of the Gold Bug, a big story that he won, a holy quoting story, or the many times he was able to do The Raven. When they heard that, they heard the delivery of something brilliant. They see the poise of a man that was proud of what he was doing. Wasn't exactly wealthy at all. Sort of kind of a drab kind of fellow, trying to dress the best he can, but always neat. They always said he was neat. Always polite, thanked people, read brilliantly, people were moved. Remember, they didn't have no films back there, so Edgar Allan Poe comes to the town, wants to read The Raven, that's like a big movie. That's a huge event. People were paying for that, to go see that and hear that. That's certainly not the ramblings of a drunk man. Remember, people who have those situations in their lives, alcohol and drugs or everything, especially if they're creative people, it eventually destroys all of that. You don't get to do it by navigating around it. Yeah, I think I'll put some 3 hours down of some super hardcore writing, and then I'm going to go get blasted for the rest of the night and do it again the next day. It doesn't work that way, because that would imply some discipline. That would imply that you have control. The whole point of this addiction, the whole point of all of this stuff, is you don't really have a lot of control. It goes away from you because that thing only gets worse and worse, that addiction. So, I mean, over the course of his life, if any of that was true, I mean, none of this would be happening. He wouldn't even be able to make those performances. You know, he'd be shaky and sound silly and look like he's about to fall apart. And that's not that they don't report that at all. They might report a pale, pasty guy that probably didn't have a great diet because he didn't have a lot of money. You know, a man obviously depressed because the women kept dying all around him. But he's still over there with character and poise and presence. Some of the women comments were like, this dude had it. I don't know if they meant back then that, you know, he was some kind of a secret romantic sexy kind of guy or something. Who knows what they really meant by that, you know. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm a guy and I see a couple of his photographs and, you know, I'm not feeling that. I'm not reading that into it. And so, hey, you know, but maybe some girls back then, you know, he could have been considered, you know, intriguing or their version of hot. You never know. I know one thing for sure, that if he lived long enough, you know, with some white hair and everything and, you know, rocking on that mustache, you know, he probably would have been looking super awesome. And out there on a college set, I mean, I guarantee you that guy would have been, like, throwing women off of him. You know, especially if he got into the heyday of all his stuff. Imagine how much he could have ended his life in a real successful way. So it's a true tragedy for him to die in such a ridiculous and an embarrassing way. So we know from the biographers, a couple of them that came on board in the last 30 years, I'd say, that they really simply cleared all this nonsense up. We also know, too, that we got a few places that establishes museums in his honor that saved a lot of his works and they did a lot of study of him on their own to talk to the public, educate him. Got one over there in Richmond, Virginia. Got another one over there in Baltimore where he died at. And, of course, where he's buried at the cemetery there. We got something over in the center over there in Boston. I know there's a house that he lived in Bronx. So there's like, you know, four or five locations. You know, they all have something about him. Many of them have some of his letters. I think the one over in Virginia actually has his socks. I mean, I didn't get a chance to visit that one yet. But, you know, I don't know if I really care about seeing his socks or not. But they have it, and that's kind of cool. I understand they have a lot of his letters, a lot of his work, some of his personal belongings, and they know a lot about him. You know, he wasn't that mysterious when you break it on down. You know, it's just almost like a never ending tale of tragedies for this guy. You know, parents die, all the women he loves dies. You know, many of the opportunities he could have had, a writer died because, you know, they kept getting magazines that he edited that wound up not doing well and falling apart and financially. He's always seeking money, you know, always hungry, you know. I laugh at the fact that this guy's broke so many times. I mean, how could he even afford it to be drunk or full of opium? That costs money, you know. So you think about that. Even if he had a drinking problem, so to say. I mean, he probably couldn't have supported it too well. He probably would have been forced to be sober just because he was broke. Just trying to keep the, you know, roof over his head and keep the writing going. You know, I don't mean to make a joke out of it. I'm just saying on the most logical way when you're thinking about that, as you're learning things about him, you know, it just makes a lot of sense. You know? Well, let's talk a little bit about his death. Well, it's been talked about many times over, okay? Obviously the evil, jealous biographies of him. Yeah. See, the way he died is exactly like I'm telling you he lived. He died a drunk fool and nobody cares and too bad. Have a good day. No, doesn't seem to be the case. Okay. They find this man on an election day. Looked like he was robbed. Dead. It looks like he might have had a drink or two at a bar, and then many a times what they used to do back then is they'd grab people, get them drunk on purpose so that they can go vote a couple of times to help their candidate out. It looks like in many instances from what we've discovered so far, he just might have been in the case of that unfortunate thing happening. They brought him to a couple of bars, made him drink a bit, you know, and, you know, bought those things for him and got him over there to vote a couple of times. Unfortunately, after they did that, they left him alone, and it probably didn't take much for him to go leave one of these places because he probably didn't have any money or very much to spend in that. He's already drunk, and he passes out in an alleyway on a cold night. Bam, you die of exposure. It's not an unusual thing. I'm told my grandfather died that way. Man who had shell shock from World War II, went out a lot one day, had a couple of drinks, fell asleep on the bench in the park in the winter, and they found him frozen the next day, that next morning. It's not an unusual thing to happen. But that's how this poor man died at the age of 40. And unfortunately, his enemies used his life, they used his writings, and then they used his death as a way to defame him, to slander a brilliant man who, from all intents and purposes, might have been a little grumpy kind of a guy, but no one's ever said he was out there being some evil, mean man. He wasn't out there bothering people. He's trying to live his life the best he could, trying to take care of the women that loved him and that he loved. So I don't know how that makes the guy bad. We got plenty of examples of bad out there. This would not be one of them. But unfortunately, those sad sacks that made fun of him and tried to hurt him, they failed. And we won't remember them or care about anything they have to say or do, because now we know who we're talking about over here. Edgar Allan Poe, one of the most brilliant writers that ever existed, invented the detective story, invented science fiction stories, brought back romantic, almost classical poetry back to our day. Because even in the 1800s, it was extremely old at that point, and he brought it back in a different way. He showed how it is to be a man of modest means and still believe in your vision, still live it, never wavering from it, never try to do anything that would harm writing. His literary criticism might have been ruthless at times, but apparently when they studied that, they even found that a lot of it was simply correct from the way he judged things. Because he left a path for us to see that. And he left a path for us to see how a writer can excel if he works hard at it, if he rewrites, if he cares about what he's doing, if he lives on the principles that are necessary as an artist, and particularly as a writer. Well, until next time, folks, we want to do a few more of these shows down the line. I like to do one on Aldous Huxley, his life, Brave New World, and you know, and beyond. George Orwell, definitely want to talk about 1984, the English colonial system, his idea of words being used as weapons. Incredible, influential guy. I like to talk about James Baldwin and some of his incredible writing, and also being black and how that affected him and what he was trying to do to make the society better, you know, in the 50s and 60s in the United States. So I'm pretty excited to go forward some of these as the time goes by. Stick with me and stick with the show. Thank you for helping me make it a success. And until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.